It is it's incredibly easy to just completely lose all context when we start throwing around massive macroeconomic
Oh,
numbers.
absolutely. The scale just sort of, washes over you.
Right, exactly. But I want you, the listener, to just hold a specific figure in your mind for a second. $6.42 trillion.
Yeah. Which is just an unbelievable amount of money.
It really is. That is the global e-commerce sales figure for the year 2025. And it represents a 6.8% jump from the previous year. We have moved far beyond people occasionally opening a laptop to like order a book. We're looking at the absolute complete mobile takeover of retail infrastructure.
Yeah, it's a structural paradigm shift in how commerce operates.
Yeah.
And, the business is capturing the most significant revenue in that multi-trillion dollar space. They are not doing it by maintaining a desktop website that just responsively shrinks down to fit a smartphone screen.
No, definitely not.
They're dominating through dedicated custom mobile applications.
Which is our objective for today's deep dive. We're utilizing insights from the Comprehensive Guide to E-commerce App Development, which includes some really extensive developer data from Scopic.
Yeah, the Scopic data is super revealing.
It really is. So our mission is to decode the architecture of these custom mobile apps. We are going to examine the engineering, the financial strategies, and the invisible logic making them function. Okay, let's unpack
Let's
this.
do it.
Before we look at the code, we need to establish the baseline. Like, why invest in an app when mobile browsers are, well, perfectly functional?
It basically comes down to the difference between a passive information portal and a proactive ecosystem. Like a mobile website functions like a digital brochure.
Right, it just sits there.
Exactly. A user has to remember it exists, physically navigate to it, and initiate the interaction themselves. But an e-commerce app, that is a highly personalized virtual retail environment installed directly on the device.
So it's always with you?
Always. It provides tools that simply do not exist on the open web. You get hardware-level push notifications to re-engage dormant users, integrated gamification to incentivize daily logins, and, closed-loop loyalty programs.
Which I imagine drastically improves retention metrics.
Oh, absolutely. It's a completely different ballgame for customer retention.
So an app allows a brand to control the environment rather than just like renting space in a web browser.
Yes, beautifully put.
But building that environment isn't this monolithic process. I mean, you can't just walk into a room and say, build me an app. You have to define the operational model first, right? Like B2B, B2C, C2B, or C2C.
Right, the acronym soup,
Yeah.
but it's critical.
Yeah, because if I'm looking at a B2B platform like an Amazon business versus a standard B2C consumer storefront, the underlying architecture has to be vastly different.
Vastly. It's not even the same sport.
I imagine B2B is engineered like a secure members-only wholesale warehouse. Like you need contracts to buy pallets of goods. You care about bulk processing and pure utility. Whereas B2C is the flashy, frictionless mall storefront designed to make you impulse buy a sweater.
What's fascinating here is how that operational distinction dictates the entire code base. In your B2C scenario, the mall storefront, the absolute highest engineering priority is frictionless speed.
Just get them to check out.
Exactly. The UI and UX are designed to take a user from discovering that sweater to finalizing the transaction in, like three taps. You are optimizing for impulsive emotional purchasing.
Remove all the barriers so I don't have time to second guess the sweater.
Right, because if you stop to think, you might not buy it. But, and this is key, if you apply that friction-free logic to a B2B application, it would be an absolute disaster.
Because corporate purchasing isn't impulsive.
No, it's heavily regulated. So B2B applications have to prioritize back-end complexity over front-end aesthetics. The checkout flow actually must route through complex approval hierarchies.
Like getting a manager to sign off on a massive order.
Exactly. The code has to dynamically generate custom pricing based on individualized client contracts, process purchase orders, and manage delay payment terms like Net 30 or Net 60. The back-end heavy lifting completely overshadows the visual interface.
Okay, that makes sense. And then when you shift to C2B or C2C models like an Etsy, a Craigslist, or say a freelance marketplace, the primary architectural hurdle isn't bulk ordering or impulse buying at all. It's engineering trust between two totally anonymous individuals.
Yes. Trust becomes the foundational utility of the app. If you don't have it, the whole thing collapses.
So how does that look in the code?
Well, in a C2C environment, the database architecture has to support incredibly deep user profiles and complex, heavily weighted review algorithms to, weed out fraud. But more importantly, the financial integration changes entirely.
Because you aren't just paying a store directly.
Right. You have to build platform-managed escrow systems. So a buyer's funds are secured by the platform until the physical item is delivered and verified by the buyer. And you also need a robust back-end interface for dispute resolution.
Wow. Okay. But building that B2B wholesale logic or a complex C2C escrow system, that requires serious capital.
Oh, massive amounts of capital.
Which brings up a pretty brutal reality check for businesses.
Yeah,
how do you build out that complex approval routing code or escrow infrastructure without just burning through your entire operating budget before you even launch the thing?
Yeah, that's the startup graveyard right there.
Right. And the guide leans heavily into this MVP strategy, launching a minimum viable product.
Because the MVP strategy is essentially mandatory if a company wants to survive that initial development phase. If you look at the pricing data provided by Skagabic, the cost scaling is incredibly steep.
Okay, let's put this in perspective for you listening. Say you secure $50,000 in seed money to build your app. According to the data, you are immediately priced out of features like AI personalization and automated marketing.
Yeah, not even close.
Those advanced tier features demand upwards of $150,000 and over a year of development. Even a multi-vendor marketplace app starts at $120,000 just to get off the ground.
It's a huge investment.
So for $50,000, you're playing in the mid-level tier, which it gets you user accounts, advanced filters, wish lists. And if you drop down to $30,000, you are looking at a strict MVP, a product catalog, a shopping cart, and a secure checkout. Literally nothing else.
It is a bare-bones operational shell.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Wait, I have to challenge this logic for a second.
Sure, go for it.
You're advising a business to launch a bare-bones app. But if my first experience downloading a brand's new app is clunky and it's missing basic modern features like Apple Pay integration or a simple wish list, I am deleting it immediately. Doesn't an MVP strategy risk burning your most eager early adopters by giving them an underwhelming product?
It is a highly valid fear, for sure. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, you have to weigh that localized risk against systemic company-ending risk.
Okay, explain that.
Well, imagine you secure that $150,000 in funding. You spend 12 months building out dynamic wish lists, machine learning product recommendations, automated abandoned cart recovery, all the bells and whistles.
Or like a great app.
You launch this flawless, feature-rich application, and then you discover that your core demographic actually prefers purchasing your specific industrial component on their desktop computer at the office.
Oh, so you just torched $150,000 on a platform nobody actually wants to use.
Exactly. You torch the capital and a full year of operational runway based on an unverified assumption.
Right.
The MVP is not about delivering a half-baked product. It is a strategic tool for market validation.
Ah, I see.
You spend $30,000 to acquire real-world data, proving that your target audience is actually willing to navigate your catalog and finalize a checkout on a mobile device.
You're essentially buying proof of concept.
Exactly. Once you have revenue flowing and behavioral data confirming the demand, then you reinvest to build out the mid-level features. You build upon verified success rather than gambling your entire budget on assumptions.
Okay, viewing the MVP as data acquisition rather than a finished product, well, that changes the calculus entirely.
It's the only safe way to play it.
So let's say we have our budget tiered and we are ready for the first development sprint. Let's look at what is actually happening under the hood. The guide breaks down the back-end infrastructure servers like AWS or Google Cloud, but it gets highly specific on the database selection.
Yeah, the database architecture is where a lot of development projects create massive bottlenecks for themselves later on. You simply cannot pick a database system at random.
The guide contrasts PostgreSQL with MongoDB, for example. I'm assuming developers deploy them for completely different functions within the same app.
Yes, they serve fundamentally opposing structural needs. So PostgreSQL is a relational database. It is highly structured, rigid, and strictly enforces data integrity.
So what do you use that for?
You deploy a relational database when you are handling financial transactions, inventory accounts, or user credentials. It locks that data down so it is perfectly consistent across the board.
No room for error with people's money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But MongoDB, that is a NoSQL database. It is fluid and schemaless.
Okay, meaning what, practically?
Meaning you utilize a NoSQL database to quickly serve up a massive, ever-changing catalog of unstructured data. Things like high-resolution product images, variable product descriptions, or thousands of user reviews. A robust e-commerce app relies on both, utilizing APIs like RESTful or GraphQL to pull that disparate data together and feed it to the front-end user interface.
I want to isolate something you just touched on, the API pulling data to the front-end, because this leads to probably the most fiercely debated topic in mobile development.
I know where you're going with this.
The mobile approach itself, choosing between native development and cross-platform development.
It is arguably the single most consequential technical decision a development team will make.
Right. So cross-platform development, utilizing frameworks like Flutter or React Native, allows developers to write one single code base that functions on both Apple iOS and Android devices. It's frequently described as a universal translator.
That's the common pitch, yeah.
But looking at the mechanics of it, I feel like that metaphor kind of misses the operational reality.
How would you frame the mechanism then?
Well, it seems less like a universal translator and more like hiring an interpreter who has to physically run back and forth between the application's code and the phone's native hardware processor.
That's actually a great way to put it.
Right. They have to use a software bridge to communicate. It works, and obviously it saves you the budget of hiring two separate development teams. But that extra interpretive step across the bridge, that is where you experience performance lag and battery drain.
That is a highly accurate assessment of the mechanics.
Yeah.
Native development, meaning writing the app in Swift, specifically for iOS, and Kotlin, specifically for Android, eliminates that interpreter entirely.
So no running back and forth.
Zero. The code base speaks directly to the device's hardware. You achieve peak processing performance, superior battery optimization, and perfectly fluid animations. However,
there's always a however.
It requires nearly double the capital and double the development time because you are literally engineering two entirely separate applications.
Okay, so if a brand is building a highly visual, graphics-heavy retail app where aesthetic fluidity is the main selling point, they bite the bullet and pay for native development.
Usually, yes.
But if they are building a straightforward B2B ordering tool where utility matters way more than smooth animations, cross-platform is the efficient choice.
It is a constant calculation of utility versus aesthetic performance. But whether a company chooses native or cross-platform, none of that optimization matters if their third-party integrations fail.
Yeah. The guide highlights payment gateways and CRM platforms as critical integrations, but it hammers on inventory management software above all else. Why is inventory the absolute linchpin?
Because inventory integration is the exact point where digital code collides with physical reality.
Okay, paint a picture for me.
Consider a scenario where a brand has a massive viral moment on social media. Tens of thousands of users open the app at the same time to purchase a limited edition jacket.
A good problem to have.
You'd think so. The front-end UI is rendering beautifully. The payment API is processing credit cards flawlessly. But the API integration with the physical warehouse inventory system has a 2-minute sync delay.
Oh, wow. I see the failure point.
Yeah. During those 2 minutes, your highly optimized app just sold the exact same physical jacket to 400 different customers.
Yikes.
But you only have 50 jackets sitting on the shelf in the physical warehouse.
So you have to manually cancel 350 orders.
And you don't merely lose the revenue from those 350 sales. You generate 350 angry consumers who immediately take to social media to label your brand a scam.
That is a PR nightmare.
The digital front end wrote a check that the physical back end was incapable of cashing. Flawless real-time inventory integration is not just a luxury feature. It is the absolute bedrock of a brand's operational credibility.
You really have to have that rock-solid foundation, the real-time sync, the appropriate rigid and flexible databases before you can even begin to deploy the emerging technologies that actually alter consumer behavior.
Exactly. You can't build a penthouse on a swamp.
Right. But once the foundation is there, we are seeing AI deployed for predictive analytics and generative AI handling dynamic customer support. But the technological feature that really caught my attention structurally is augmented reality, AR virtual try-ons.
Oh, AR is rapidly becoming ubiquitous, particularly in the fashion and furniture sectors,
which have historically suffered from crippling return rates.
Yes. Returns are the profit killer of e-commerce.
So what does this all mean? The guide notes that AR integration drastically reduces those return rates. But I want to look at the behavioral economics behind why it works so effectively. It's not just the practical utility of seeing if a pair of digital sunglasses fits your face shape, or if a virtual sofa physically fits in the corner of your living room. There is an actual psychological trigger being pulled.
I know exactly what you're talking about. You are referring to the endowment effect.
Yes. When a consumer holds up their smartphone and sees a high-fidelity digital render of a sofa sitting in their actual living room, their brain subconsciously begins to take ownership of the item before they have even tapped the checkout button.
Because it's already in their house, visually.
Exactly. It feels like it already belongs in their physical space.
The cognitive friction associated with the purchase drops significantly at that point. Psychologically, they are no longer deciding whether to acquire a new item. They feel as though they were simply finalizing the paperwork on an item they already possess.
That is wild.
And consequently, when the physical item is delivered, they are statistically far less likely to initiate a return because that initial psychological bond was formed digitally weeks ago.
It fundamentally rewrites the entire dynamic of online shopping, but, and this is a massive operational but, running AR rendering, predictive AI, and hyper-personalized recommendations requires harvesting an astronomical amount of behavioral data.
It really does.
Which leads us directly into the primary minefield of modern app development, data privacy.
This raises an important question. It is the inevitable dark side of hyper-personalization.
How much data are we really talking about?
Mountains of it. To make those features function, developers are pulling in massive amounts of structured data, like financial histories and addresses, alongside unstructured data, like tracking exactly how many milliseconds a user hovered over a specific product image before scrolling away.
They track milliseconds of a hover?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But the moment an app begins hoarding that level of granular telemetry, the security requirements scale exponentially.
So we are talking about requirements far beyond just basic SSL encryption.
We are talking about surviving severe regulatory scrutiny. Legal frameworks like the GDPR in Europe or the CCPA in California, they are not suggestions. A compliance failure in data handling does not merely result in a financial penalty.
What's the worst case scenario?
Regulators can force a company to completely dismantle and rebuild their entire data architecture from scratch.
Oh, wow. That would be fatal for most startups.
Definitely. Developers have to engineer strict data minimization protocols, meaning the app is hard-coded to only collect the absolute minimum data required to function. And they must ensure that auditable user consent mechanisms are deeply baked into the user interface.
Because if you suffer a data breach, you don't just expose user telemetry, you incinerate the consumer trust we established earlier.
And consumer trust is the single metric that cannot be restored with a software patch, which is why operational stability is the final ongoing landmine. Privacy protocols protect the data, but load balancing and infrastructure scaling protect the availability of the app itself.
Right. Circling back to that viral social media moment with the jackets, if a million users hit the app simultaneously, you need cloud-based server optimization ready to scale dynamically to handle the traffic spike, or the whole system crashes.
An e-commerce app is not a static asset. It's a living, degrading ecosystem. It demands relentless integration testing and unit testing.
Because the environment around it is always changing?
Precisely. Every time Apple or Google releases a new mobile operating system, or every time a hardware manufacturer releases a device with a new screen aspect ratio, the existing code base is at risk of fracturing. The development cycle never actually concludes. It just enters a new phase of maintenance.
It really is a relentless cycle of evolution. To synthesize this journey for you listening, building a custom e-commerce application is a massive, highly strategic undertaking. You must define your architecture based on your specific business model, whether you are routing complex B2B wholesale approvals or managing C2C escrow trust.
Yeah, that foundation is everything.
You have to possess the discipline to launch a lean MVP to purchase real-world market validation before scaling. You have to navigate the technical friction between native code interpreters and cross-platform efficiency. And finally, you wield behavioral tools like AR and predictive AI, all while defending the perimeter against catastrophic privacy breaches and server failures.
It is a delicate, high-stakes balance of human psychology and heavy digital infrastructure. And to leave you with something new to mull over, we have spent this entire deep dive analyzing how to build the perfect, frictionless visual storefront for a human user.
Right.
But if predictive AI and big data analytics continue to accelerate at their current trajectory to the point where an algorithmic agent knows exactly when you are going to run out of household supplies or exactly which specific pair of running shoes you require next, what happens to the visual storefront altogether?
Wait, you mean no interface at all?
Exactly. In 5 years, you may never actually open an e-commerce app to browse. Your personal AI assistant might simply negotiate directly with the B2B warehouse APIs in the background to procure what you need.
So the ultimate, most successfully engineered e-commerce app might turn out to be one that a human being never actually looks at.
It's entirely possible.
That is a wild technological trajectory to consider. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the invisible digital architecture you interact with every day, and we will catch you next time.